Hey, everybody, a quick reminder about the listener survey that we've been running. We're going to run that until the end of next week, but if you've not taken the survey, please do. You can find that in two easy places. You can go to twitter.com/skipmefanny. It'll be a pinned tweet right at the top of our profile there. Or if you go to any of the episode posts, basically from the end of March until whenever you're listening to this in early April, there'll be a link in each of those posts to the listener survey in the show notes. So I appreciate it if you've taken the survey, and if you've not, please take a minute and do take the survey for us. We really appreciate it. So on that note, enjoy this very fun episode in which we destroy Paul's childhood.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanty Show.
Come for the robots, stay for the trippiest end sequence in science fiction cinema, torture cinema, the black hole.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm David.
I'm Julia.
I'm Rachel.
And we're here for torture cinema. Yay!
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 Yay! So we'll get into some very fun stuff in a minute, because we're watching, or did watch, The Black Hole, and we're going to talk about it. But first, we should talk about what beverage we are drinking. So I'll start with you, Paul.
Well, I have decided to try to give up Crystal Light peach iced tea, which I've been drinking gallons and gallons and gallons of for years. So right now, I am just drinking hydrogen dioxide, monoxide, a.k.a. water.
That just sounds evil when you say it like that.
Hydrogen monoxide. Feel it.
Hydrogen monoxide actually does kill a lot of people each year.
It does. I am drinking something dangerous to every human being.
Why is it mono? I thought it's got two.
Dihydrogen
monoxide would be the better definition. Thank you, geologist Rachel.
You're welcome.
I don't understand anything. Okay. David.
You're not a science major.
I'm not a science major. David, what are you consuming?
I am consuming red rose tea in my Iron Hands mug, as one does.
Perfect, perfect. Julia?
I am about to be, right this second, as I am handed this beautiful mug, consuming chai with vanilla cinnamon Baileys in it.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing. Oh, that's
it is.
Good.
I just took a drink. That is amazing.
That does sound good. I feel jealous now.
I might have some drink envy, but only a little.
Well, what are you drinking, Rachel?
I am drinking an amaretto sour, a double amaretto sour that was made for me by my excellent roommate, Cavi.
Excellent. Is it good?
It is very good. She is a certified mixologist.
Wow.
Get a mixology degree.
You go to bartending school for 3 weeks.
And you watch Cocktail?
I don't know.
I actually have one of those too. I'm tips certified and everything.
Really?
Yes. It means tips is the safe service one, which means that I am certified to serve in American bars and cut people off when they've had too much to drink.
Well, I would just say this right now, announcing officially the Skiffy and Fanty party at Convergence, bartended by Julia.
Nope, I did not sign up for that.
Aww.
Wah, wah.
Just because I can do it doesn't mean I will.
And we'll pay you.
Nope.
Okay.
Seems like a lot of liability that I don't really want to take on.
Fair enough. Well, I am drinking something that I am calling a bloody black hole.
Which,
so now we're talking about a David Cronenberg film.
Not good at all.
Well, it was just a black hole. And then I added some cranberry to it, and so it became a bloody black hole. Yeah, so
what's in a black hole, Sean?
So a black hole is one part Kraken rum, one part amaretto, and one part Kahlua.
That's good, actually. Sounds it, anyway.
It is pretty decent. It'll get you messed up, which is how I intend to survive the next couple hours. So, yeah. So, yeah, enjoy that. Enjoy that little bit of laughter inside your soul. So, shall we get into discussing the black hole?
We have to?
Yes, please.
Okay. We need a plot summary.
We do need a plot summary, and since this movie is from Paul's childhood, you should describe it. Well, it may also be from yours, David, but I seem to recall Paul putting on Twitter that he was going to be the lone lover of this film and was going to have his soul ripped out. I think the tweet was exactly to the effect of, this is going to be my Mac and me.
I think that's probably very true, actually.
I will just say this, though, that objectively this film is actually kind of better than Mac and Me.
No, I would rather watch Mac and Me again.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, this is torture cinema history, because Julia said that she would never watch Mac and Me again, but we have actually found a film that she would rather not watch and watch Mac and Me instead of.
I would watch Mac and Me instead of Baby Geniuses as well, or Transformers for that matter.
Okay, yeah, she's got a point. I was going to say my feelings on the Mac and Me versus the black hole debate would really depend on how many tokes I'd had beforehand.
While you're in Colorado, of course.
Well, yes. Or, probably, tab of acid, black hole, maybe not. I don't know what would be scarier, the bad trip off of black hole or the bad trip off of Mac and Me. It's a tight race.
God, I feel like if you were tripping on acid, Mac and Me would be a horror movie. And Black Hole
already is a horror movie, Sean.
That was my thesis on that podcast, and I was not proven wrong.
And I guess for Paul and for me, the question is redundant, because I'm assuming we both have multiple viewings of the Black Hole under our belts.
I just rewatched it twice in the last week. So
there we go.
Does that tell you?
So, Paul, please describe this film for those poor souls who have not yet witnessed The Black Hole.
The Black Hole is a 1979 Disney film following the adventures of the crew of the Palomino, who are going to look for signs of intelligent life in outer space. In so doing, they come across a monster black hole and a missing ship, the Cygnus, that had disappeared decades earlier. Upon investigating the Cygnus and having some physical difficulties along the way, they find that the ship is not a derelict, but instead its captain is very much alive, although surrounded by robots, and our dear captain wants to go into the black hole. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and the deep dark secret at the center of the ship soon swallows the Palomino and sends the surviving members of the crew into the trippiest ending in science fiction fandom.
It's really the trippiest ending?
I'm going to dispute that, but onwards.
I feel like 2001 has the trippier ending.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I don't know. We can argue about that. It's on my likes and dislikes.
Because the only reason – well, okay, I got to save it.
Yeah.
But okay. Any case, well, why don't we get to our likes and dislikes? And remember, the hand system is in effect.
Oh, no, that's right. Sorry.
So if Rachel would like to speak, she should use her hand.
I'm making a hand signal at you, Sean.
I can't see you because we're not using a video.
Use your imagination.
And I'm not in Houston. So, in any case, well, why don't we get started with likes? And we will start with Julia.
Oh, goodness. okay. Wow. The Vincent. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with Vincent, but in some ways I kind of like how crappy he is. I'm so sorry, Paul. I hear you whimpering. But he's kind of cute. He's really, really terrible if you compare him to R2-D2. but he's kind of cute.
That is hilarious.
That's about all I can. I'm sorry, guys. I really didn't love this movie.
I like your positive description of Vincent is he's only kind of crappy.
Well, he's pretty crappy. I mean, like, honestly, the special effects in this movie, that I shouldn't get into other items.
Okay. Well, that's fair. That's fair. No, Rachel, I think, wants to say something about Vincent.
Yeah, Vincent was on my list as a like because he looks like he's straight out of South Park.
Oh my god, that's true.
I could not connect that, but you're right, he does.
Imagine everything he says in like the Cartman voice.
If Cartman was a robot.
Oh my gosh. Okay, we need to find some quotes.
Oh, Paul's not going to make it through the evening.
He's not.
But, I mean...
Poor Paul.
I actually really like Vincent for the most part, but then Vincent's existence as his adorable South Park-esque self actually leads to one of my dislikes, so...
Okay, well...
So I will say this for Vincent, though. I like the way that he will, like, hide from things by putting his top down so his eyes are hidden, like, when he doesn't like something.
Like he's 2 years old, and if he can't see them...
Yeah, like, you can't see me because I can't see you. I am Vincent.
It is... okay, never mind.
Can anyone do a Cartman impression?
No.
Okay, that's unfortunate. If anyone can do a Cartman impression, we will put the audio of you doing Vincent lines as Cartman in an episode. Because that sounds hilarious. So, in any case, why don't we jump to Rachel for your first like?
So, my first like... So, my playback from Vudu, because that's how I had to get this movie, started off with 2.5 minutes of black screen and an overture. Which was very puzzling. And had me and Kathy scratching our heads, because Kathy suffered through this with me. And it was like a little charming puzzle where we were trying to figure out where does the movie actually start. And it was kind of, you know, it was okay. It was like an 80s overture. It wasn't bad. So that was fun. That was more fun than the rest of the movie, was winding back and forth with the Xbox controller trying to figure out where the fucking movie started. And then the movie started and everything was fine.
Okay, so, I mean, we saw a very different movie.
I don't know what, like, it was just the version that was on Vudu. Like,
yeah, the version of the DVD I have has the overture, which is pretty interesting to, I mean, that's, 1979 is late for movies to be having overtures. I was astonished the first time I saw that, because otherwise I associate that with, you know, well, the 60s at the latest. Yeah. So that's kind of charming that, you know, it's really trying to sell it as an epic, which is hilarious with it for a 90-minute movie to have an overture. The first time I experienced one of those was Lawrence of Arabia, and I wondered why I was hearing music and the lights weren't going down, and I'd never been to a movie with an overture before. So it shows that Disney was certainly pulling out all the stops to try to make this an event.
Well, that's one way to describe what this was doing. Julia.
Yeah, so the overture really caught me off guard as well, because I've seen movies with overtures before, but usually there's something to indicate that the movie is actually doing something. Like it'll say that this is the overture, or you'll see kind of the backdrop of what the credits will be while the overture is playing. But this was just straight up black screen, to the point at which about a minute and a half in, I asked Moss, like, is there a problem with the video? Do we need to, like, stop it and try to resync it? Because we rented it from iTunes or something. And we, like, looked, and then we fast-forwarded a few minutes and realized that, nope, actually, it was the overture, and it would eventually start. And that was a very confusing. So, Rachel, I totally second your confusion on that one. But I also second the liking. It was pretty nice.
Paul?
Yeah, I might as well get my like away. I'll say it's the overture, and... The DVD version, and David can confirm this, as he has to do, it says the Black Hole Overture on the screen for the entire length of the overture.
But I think what the others must have seen would have been essentially like the theatrical. Like in the theater, you would not have seen anything on the screen. The curtains wouldn't have parted. You would have just heard the music.
Oh, Yeah, okay. But yeah, but I am charmed by the overture because, well, yes, it is only a 98-minute film, which is kind of odd to have an overture, and it is late in doing overtures, but that's why I like it. It's kind of retro and strange and odd that way. And I like the music of the film, so I'm totally okay and totally like the fact that there's an overture involved. I mean, it pads out the movie a little, and it's kind of weird in this day and age, but I'm sorry. I'm not very, what's the word, objective when it comes to this film. So yeah, I like the overture.
So I'm really confused because the beginning of the film I watched was like opening credits, which had music.
Yeah, but you didn't get the overture. The overture rehearses the main themes of the music throughout the film. So you would have heard like a Reader's Digest version of all the music you were going to hear in the movie. And then the main theme begins.
Yeah, so that basically happened for about 2 minutes where it cycled through all of the different themes. And then after that was done, it had a little flourishing finale. And then they started the credits with the main theme again.
Right. So like what would now happen actually in the end credits in some films where they would just kind of like in the Star Wars movies, the end credits has
sort of, but really quicker? more like an overture when you, if you've ever gone to see a musical, like Wicked or any of those, I don't know what kinds of musicals you might have seen, but like any Broadway musical will still have an overture in a live performance. And basically before the play starts, the orchestra plays all of the main songs in like excerpts of them to get you in the mood.
So if you watch like the DVDs of the Ten Commandments or Lawrence of Arabia or the original King Kong, you'll get those first few minutes of like a preview of the music to come.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I didn't get that in the version I watched, which is really sad because I actually really liked the music for this film. I think sometimes it's not as well put together with the rest of the film. That's a dislike we'll get to later, which isn't specific to the music. It's more to things we'll talk about. But I'm with you, Paul, that John Barry's score for this is really, really good. I mean, you could recognize the themes. It really captures some of the emotional moments, mostly the kind of very tense moments. It's really, really good. And I really like the music. And that's just something I like is if a film has a really good score, I'm not going to forgive the film for sucking, but at least I'll have something I really like. So there's that.
I'll second that for my like. Also, the main theme I find really haunting and majestic, and sometimes it gets overused. But overall, whenever I see the opening credits and hear that music, I keep thinking it's going to be this time. It's going to be the movie that I waited so many years for it to be when it was being announced back when I was 10, 11, 12.
Interesting. Well, all right. It looks like we have cycled through the first likes, so it's now time for dislikes. So we're going to go the other way around. David, we're going to start with you.
In the Wikipedia entry, they mention Neil deGrasse Tyson considering it the most inaccurate science space exploration movie ever, which is a tall order, given that that includes things like Catwoman of the Moon. But I remember, one of my big dislikes, I looked forward to this film so much when it was being made. I was reading about it in Famous Monsters of Filmland. I was so excited. And I missed it in its blink and you missed a theatrical run. But when I did finally catch it on television, I remember staring in horror at the climax as they're clambering around the outside of the spaceship without spacesuits.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of windy. I remember my jaw hitting my early adolescent jaw hitting the ground and just, thinking like, I can't think of any other film, no matter how cheap, from any era that pulled such a colossal, idiocy.
Yeah. So that's actually my dislike. And I wrote down exactly this, which is in the black hole, there is no such thing as the vacuum of space or logical physics of any kind. It doesn't even do the kind of pop physics, which is still wrong, but like seems like it might actually kind of be true, like Armageddon, which is wrong about almost everything. But for some reason we kind of forgive it because it kind of seems like it might be real. This film just the hot whippersnapper kid, whatever his stupid name is, where he just like flies off into space.
Yeah.
And the trash can Winnie the Pooh goes and saves him. Oh, I'm
it's
sorry,
just
no, that's
windy
Bob.
In space.
It's not Winnie the Pooh. I'm sorry. It's Anne Robinson from The Weakest Link. Yeah, and goes and saves him, and it's like it's no big deal. Or like when they're in the biodome, and it's been ruptured, and so it's really cold, and they just like they like crawl out. They like use plants like as rope, and then they pull themselves out and then open a door and get out. And they're like, "Brr, it's cold." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, but if it had got that cold, you would have just frozen to death because it's the vacuum of space." There's no explanation for it, any of it. It's just sort of like, it seems like when they got into a hole, they're like, we want the ship to start to explode, but we also want our characters to be able to run through exploding areas in order to be heroic. Well, if we just test out the physics, that's possible. It's like just
but
really convenient.
But all that happens before they cross the event horizon. They're still outside the black hole. It's just kind of windy and cold in space. I mean, even when they're on the little transport that the little train thing that stops at one point because the track's been smashed by a meteor, there's you know, all they do is get out and go through a door.
Right.
It's no big deal.
Paul?
Yeah, I might as well. Like, I think I'm up for my first dislike too. And it is the physics for 3/4 of the movie is unfortunately pants for the reasons why you unfortunately described. I understand from reading about the movie and whatnot, they didn't want – the actors basically refused to wear spacesuits because they were bulky. Well, they were bulky and crappy and they just didn't want to do it, so they decided not to do it. And that's why we don't have – that's why we have them going through areas where they should have suffocated or frozen to death or both. And the scene where Charlie Pires is floating out into space, yeah, he should have been dead long before Vincent Bob grabbed him. So, or the track scene, or any, or the biodome, or any other stuff. I mean, I'll get into like later, but I mean, the movie starts off fine, but then quickly decides to drop any pretensions of physics whatsoever in the film, and that is a major weakness, I will admit.
Wait, so let me get this straight. They wanted them to have spacesuits, but the actors said, well, gee golly, that'll be too inconvenient and cumbersome for a film about fucking space.
Yeah.
So we're not going to wear them, even though it makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
That's basically that's the story, yeah.
I'm sorry, but they could have found other actors.
Well, they had done most of the filming by that point. And you're going to replace every actor.
But they had a script. They could have said, they could have, like, that should be one of the interview questions. I think from now on, based on this story, every film set in space should, like, one of the interview questions should be, are you willing to wear a fake spacesuit? And if they answer no, then you say, I'm sorry, but we can't hire you for the role.
I'm just reporting what I read, man.
Wow. What a bunch of turds. Like, everyone, even Ernest Borgnine?
Well, he wasn't it. Remember, he doesn't survive to that point, so.
Oh, that's right. He blows up in the spaceship.
Yeah, so he never had to.
He probably would have. They should have made him the captain. God, wow. Okay. I now have even less respect for this movie. Because now it's just, like, ridiculous. So, well, Rachel, why don't we jump to you?
Okay, so I'll start off with my number one dislike being the fact that production design wise, I don't feel like this movie had any original ideas because you had like not R2-D2, who was from South Park, but that was before this movie's time. And then you had like the fucking child of a Cylon and a blender.
Oh, come on.
Who just wants to make you a smoothie, a people smoothie. And then
he literally wants to make you a smoothie.
I mean, there was just so much stuff in here where I was like, oh my god, I feel like I'm watching somebody's bad copy of Star Wars with all like the not stormtroopers or, you know, the not a Cylon or the robots, which were not nearly as engaging as the robots in Star Wars. And then like the generic space jumpsuits. And then, like, the character Harry, who is, like, sweaty, not quite Jimmy Doohan. And that bothered me a lot, too. It just annoyed the crap out of me.
Oh, God. No.
And then, like, you know, the you know, Mr. I wanted to shoot everything, like, you know, I was going, I don't know, it's like, are you trying to be Luke Skywalker? I don't know. It really annoyed me because I felt like I could just watch how many movies it was kind of like trying to steal design elements from instead of being its own very whole thing. Because especially when you looked at, like, the Stormtrooper Cylon robots versus fucking Vincent, like, it looked like it was made of an agglomeration of a bunch of different movies instead of having an actual design aesthetic of its own, and I didn't like that.
Yeah, we'll be coming to what you just said a little bit later, I suspect, because that would be some other dislike.
Oh my.
Oh yeah, I got problems with the robots, but we'll come to that later. So, Julia, your first dislike.
So, my first dislike is probably just going to be the opposite end of the Vincent one. So while I kind of enjoyed Vincent, I also just, Moss at one point, early on was like, this came out after Star Wars. And I was like, yeah, is it really worse than Star Wars? And then immediately, like within 10 seconds, we were both like, yes, it is much worse than Star Wars. Special effects wise, it's terrible. And one of the things that's terrible is the robots. Like, if you look at Vincent compared to R2-D2, R2-D2 is hands down a much better, more convincing looking robot. Vincent looks like he might be made of cardboard. Like, maybe someone took an old Quaker Oats canister and painted some eyes on it. And then painted some other things with silver spray paint. And he's literally pieces of cardboard. I'm not sure. So that was kind of horrible. And he has a kind of charming voice, but he's nowhere near as charming as C-3PO. So, and I couldn't help it. I kept comparing these robots to other robots that are in other things. And it just, it made me sad because I want to like cute robots, but they didn't actually make me like them. And, it's just, it's very sad. Like, I thought about all the kids like David out there who spent the years up to 1979 eagerly anticipating what Disney was going to cook up for them, because it's Disney. Disney does exciting things, and they were going to do this big movie that they had a big budget for, and it was going to be called The Black Hole, and that's awesome. And then what they got was this, and that's super sad. I'll probably talk about special effects more in a later item.
Fortunately, so that same year, we also got Alien, so it turned out all right.
Yeah, and Alien, so much better.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. I will just say that that given that this film was, I believe, $20 million to make and $6 million for advertising, so $20 million just for production, at least half of that probably went into Vincent and the giant cosmic space anus. So it's really kind of sad when you think about it in those terms. And I think I should just get my dislike out of the way, unless other people are going to have dislikes about the robots, because Julie has already brought up the robots.
Go for it.
I'm going to have different items about different robots later.
Okay.
But you should go ahead, because I think my next one is going to be a like.
Okay. Well, let's see here. I mostly hated the robots. The evil robots were like kind of, okay, whatever. But I think the moment at which I hated the robots was when Trash Can 1, Vincent, has the fight with Max, the Blender Cylon, as Rachel described him. And I just felt like the more I watched this scene, the more I'm like, the special effects just aren't good enough for this fight to work. Because it's just sort of like he's shooting lasers, like Vincent's shooting lasers, and Max is coming closer, and then they like hug. Well, Max mostly hugs because Max has arms. So he hugs him, and then like the fight continues, and it's really dull, and he keeps shooting him, but it doesn't work because Max is like made out of diamonds or something. And then he just like drills through his heart. And that's the end of the big conflict. And it's super anticlimactic, and I just felt like why did they need this at all? Why wouldn't it have made more sense for them, like, because there's physically it just doesn't look good. It's like this weird, like, it's on wires, it's floating around, and they're like bumping each other and hugging each other, and that's it. So I mostly hated that scene. I also mostly hated the robots in general, and I agree with Julia that the second those big South Park-y eyes come up, I couldn't take it seriously. And that'll be something I'll come to later, because there's a reason why I have issues with the film. But that's, again, one of those things. So I will not get to go next round for dislikes, but we should go, I guess, at this point to our second like with David.
Well, I really liked the Cygnus. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, but, working as I do in a universe where we have gigantic cathedral spaceships with huge marble vaults inside, I liked the majesty of it and the it's screw you approach to any kind of sensible spaceship design. It looked great. And that seems to be where the special effects were also at their strongest. So the early sights of it floating all black and derelict, and then when it suddenly lights up, and inside it was a little more underwhelming and kind of bland for much of it. Though I did like the gigantic spaces, but on the whole, I remain quite fond of the Cygnus.
Fair enough. All right. Anyone have any thoughts? Or, Paul, you want to go to your next like?
My next like, I'll make it simple. Well, sorry, Rachel, go ahead.
I just wanted to know, David, are you getting down with the Cygnus?
God.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well, come on. That song's great. Anyway, Paul, shall you save us?
Okay, well, I'm gonna make this podcast simple, and David's making it simple for me. So my second like is also going to be the cathedral-like beauty of the Cygnus. It's gorgeous as a seeming derelict, and then when it lights up, it's like, that's magic. I like that. It's got big wide opens. It's completely impractical with all that glass. And when the meteors show up, we'll get to the meteors in another segment. It just shows that it's impractical, but it's just so fucking gorgeous. It's like,
and then we get that main theme again.
Yes, and we get that main theme. It's like, yes, this is what I like. And the interiors are huge. I mean, it's not a cramped, dirty spaceship like, say, no offense, Alien. I mean, this is a proper spaceship you'd want to go to the stars with. You want to ride it in the Cygnus as long as nothing bad happened to it. But yeah, I love the look of the Cygnus. I mean, yes, you can also see some where they took design elements. I know you're all down on that. I mean, the whole rising up to the command tower, that whole area looks a lot like, a certain area of the Death Star. I know. But the Cygnus is a gorgeous ship. And that's my like.
All right, Rachel.
All right. Let's see. The opening credits, the green computer-generated grid, takes me back to my childhood of wireframe graphics. Yeah.
Wow.
Fond memories.
The opening credits are awesome.
I do like that it's got that classic, you know. Spatial depression thing going.
Yeah, it's very cosmos that way.
Yep.
That doesn't feel like a like to me.
Well, too bad. I had a hard time coming up with likes.
Okay. Well, Julia, what about you?
I will, like, jump on the bandwagon for the main theme music, which, everybody else did last round, but I didn't. I really do like the main theme. It's very pretty. It's very haunting. And it makes you think this movie is going to be exciting and eerie and weird and strange and fun and spooky. And instead, you get this movie. But the music is gorgeous.
Okay. Seems like almost all of us agree about the music. So that's good. There's a little bit of agreement, guys. This is a good start.
It's okay, Sean. I've already accepted my fate in this movie. That's okay. But we play out the string anyway.
I can't wait to see Paul's grade. It's gonna be fun. My second like is despite the fact that that there is some issues with originality. Overall, I actually liked the sets. I thought the sets were better designed than certain other aspects of the film. I suppose that would include the outer view of the Cygnus, but overall, I really liked the sets. I thought the sets were really evocative. And overall, we did a pretty good job. Paul?
Oh, yeah. I just want to make one last note about the Cygnus. One thing I didn't get for a couple years after is the significance of the name, the Cygnus.
Cygnus X1.
What exactly. I didn't know it when the first time I saw it, but later on I was like, oh, that's clever. I like that. Cygnus X1, for those listeners who don't know, was the first black hole ever discovered.
Oh. Okay. I didn't know that. Well, there we go. All right. Julia, your second dislike.
Second dislike...
You have so many. pick as
so
you will.
So hard to choose. My second dislike is going to be the plot of this, which just doesn't actually hold together at all and is terrible. Tied up in that is the pacing of this movie is terrible. Like halfway through, I was literally in pain and felt like I was dying. And it's partly the movie's fault and it's partly not the movie's fault because I was feeling bad before I started watching it. But like the movie actively made me feel worse, which I will get to in a later item. However, halfway through it, I was like, it has to be almost over. How long do we have left? And we stopped it to check the progress and it was only halfway done. And I mean, it's not a long movie, so that is severe pacing problems. Plus just like the plot, what even is that plot? I don't. I'm disappointed in you, Disney.
Well, like the plot, it would be fine if it just decided to stick with the plot that it should have just stuck with, which
or if it decided to have something happen.
Right. Well, like there's one main plot, which is, you know, this ship it's basically the Event Horizon thing, like, minus the, we actually went through the black hole and crazy shit came out, and then I'm gonna eat my own eyes out of my face, you know, minus that part. but it's like, basically that's the premise, is like, this ship's supposed to be has disappeared, and then these, like, explorers discover it, and they're like, well, that's weird, and it lit up, but like, we should go check it out, which is probably stupid, but whatever. Right, and then they get in there, and then they find crazy scientist dude, and they're like, oh, well, this guy's kind of kooky, but maybe he's actually found some stuff. And then, he actually killed all of his crew, and then we've now got to escape. But the problem is the point at which they discover he's, like, turned all the crew into robots, like, comes, like, after the hour mark. You know, so you've spent an hour
like,
where
also
nothing happens.
They get in there, and he's, like, crazy scientist guy with all of his demonic-looking robots. And they're just like, oh, yeah, that's totally normal.
No,
of course he would have a bunch of demon robots.
They say he's eccentric. They argue about it. Yeah, they bring this up. They bring up, like, okay, he's got a few screws loose. I mean, Dr. McCrae says at one point he's walking the tightrope between genius and insanity. So they bring up the fact that, okay, he's really out there. But on the other hand, he's developed anti-gravity, a lot of power, and looks like ready to go through a black hole. So he's crazy, but he's also brilliant. So yeah, we should probably find out more about this. We can't just walk away. And by the time they finally decide to walk away, well, things take a bad turn and he's decided to liquidate them.
But the problem is all of that actual plot occurs in the last 30 minutes when it's clear, I think everybody kind of realizes pretty much in the first 10 minutes, as soon as they meet the guy and like you spend 5 minutes with him, you're like, well, they may not realize it, but we all know that he killed the other crew or did something to the other crew.
And so at that point, it's sort of like, why are we spending 40, 50 minutes waiting for them to figure this truth out? Why don't we get to it and then have most of the film be like they're trying to escape in a big old ship like the Cygnus while the guy's trying to like launch it through, you know, a cosmic space anus, and then we can get to it. But it's, it just doesn't, it's not, it takes so long to get to the actual
plot. Or like
plot.
Even you could fix it in other ways too, because Kate is interested in going there because her father served on that ship. So she has a valid reason to want to go there.
Sure.
And they get on there, and the first thing that happens is they talk to him and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, your father's dead. So case closed, she has nothing more to do there because her father's dead. They could have made it so that like the ship robots who are actually made of former crew members realize that she's, you know, her father, some piece of him is still there and trying to either save her or warn her or avenge him, you know, and have them like leaving clues for her and trying to help her or whatever. They never do anything like that, but that would have given it some kind of tension.
Sure. It would also have given, well, never mind, because I suspect that's going to be something you're going to bring up later, Julia, but I will save that comment. Rachel, you want to jump in?
No, I mean, I mostly just want to say, like, it's, I very much agree, because there is just the entire first two-thirds of the movie are, like, front-loaded with all this, Reinhardt is crazy, there's a thing going on, we, you know, like, trying to drop clues to heighten the tension, but there is no tension, the stakes really don't feel that high, because it's like, we need to repair our ship and get out of there, and then that just seems to kind of, like, drift off because we're too busy being like, you know, not Jimmy Doohan is like sneaking around and being like, that robot's walking with a limp. Like, I figured out that the crew had been turned into robots, like, you know, after about the second hint. I was like, oh, okay, so this is where we're going with it? All right. And then it took like another half an hour to even fucking get anywhere with it. 45 minutes maybe. And it was just like, get to the point. It's very badly paced writing. And I know older movies tend to be much more slower paced in that way, like, than the ones we get now, which I'm not saying that, you know, what we get now is necessarily better, but, you know, like, Star Wars didn't have that kind of problem. You didn't spend your time being like, my God, are we still on Tatooine?
Well, I think that Star Wars is the exception that proves rule, but this is very much more like the 70s film, like, say, Westworld, in that there's a long, long build-up to when things actually really take off. And I will admit, I'm going to jump in here and say this is going to be a second. Like, I have written here very slow to start, and it is true. It takes a very long time compared to the running length of the movie for the plot to really hit. It's a bug, especially for modern audiences. And I know they've talked for years about trying to reboot this thing. It's about the only thing they haven't rebooted in the last 10 years. But they could do so much with this as far as the plot and the script and making it better paced or more epic or one or the other. As it is, it kind of sits in the wrong space. It's 100 minutes and the plot takes a long time to actually finally get going. So that is my second dislike.
So I will just note to you, Paul, that The Black Hole is being rebooted. They're doing a remake.
They've said that for years. I'll believe it when I see names and directors and real things.
It'll double bill with the Logan's Run remake?
Exactly.
Well, they have names attached to it, but it's been a couple of years since we heard any new stuff about it, so I'm not clear that it's actually being made.
It's the same guy who did Tron 3, Joseph Kaczynski.
Oh.
And in 2013, they had a writer and they had a director.
Yeah, that was 2013,
and
though. That's 2 years ago.
It now has an IMDb page.
Yeah, but
that doesn't mean anything.
Anyone can put up an IMDb page.
There's tons of movies caught in developmental hell that are up there.
It'll happen. It's Disney.
Yeah, and the writer that they had attached to it is the guy who wrote Prometheus.
Well, I'm not saying what's going to come out of it's going to be good, but
the bar's pretty low.
That was back in 2013. That was actually 2 years ago, which since we haven't heard anything after that, I would say it's a good chance this project has been put on hold again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't believe it. I believe that soon we will have it. By soon, I mean in Hollywood time, which means in 15 years. So, in any case, where are we? Who has not provided their second dislike?
I haven't yet. As Rachel?
Have I? No, I have not.
Then go, Rachel. I think you need to go, and then David needs to go.
How about the ship gets attacked by Nerds Candy?
And I- Delicious.
That would make that scene much more interesting.
Why didn't he just run out onto the surface of the ship? Because we know he didn't need a spacesuit and catch the nerds in his mouth. And it was so random, too. It wasn't like, oh, there's like, you know, an asteroid swarm coming our way. It was just like, oh, shit, we need something to happen. Nerd shower! Like, where did it even come from? It felt like the equivalent of, I don't know what to write next, so a man enters the room with a gun. Nerd space. Rocks. There we go. Yeah.
Yeah, the reason why I find this unrealistic is not only because of the bad description, how it looks, but it was really established that the Cygnus has been monitoring stuff all around. It's monitoring the black hole. It knew when the Palomino came, and even when it was dark, it knew exactly what the Palomino was doing, who they were. I would have liked to think that Dr. Reinhardt would have had sensors to detect the incoming asteroids. It would have been nice to have some forewarning. But on the other hand, the ship just had a major hit, so maybe the sensors got knocked out. Something addressing that in the movie would be nice, but because we have the Palomino crash into the ship, and then we have this happen. So it would be nice that if we had some something in the movie to justify why Reinhardt was caught off guard by the space rocks, by the nerd candy.
Yeah, that would have been nice if most anything in this film was properly foreshadowed. But alas. Well, David, your second dislike, sir.
Well, I actually went back and forth with this one as to whether it was a like or a dislike, because it's in this kind of it's getting so completely bad that it starts to turn good again. But I'm going to keep it on the side of the dislikes, given my younger self's horror when it happened, and that was when they actually go into the black hole. And setting aside the fact that you have a robot having audio flashbacks, the space trip that we get is like I was tweeting, is such a shameless act of self-plagiarism. It recreates the Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria sequence from Fantasia. And so the movie from 39 years prior did a much better job of this live action thing where it's so dumb. I kind of like the fact that we get hell and then the stained glass windows, but it's so perfunctory. And, I guess this justifies the design of apparently Maximilian was designed to look like the demon in Night on Bald Mountain. If so, it's pretty vague. It's a reminder, of just how, bad an idea it is for any movie to try to do the Stargate sequence after 2001 Space Odyssey. That's the only film that's ever been able to pull it off. Everyone else, it just comes off as kind of sad, whether it's this film better but still not working in Interstellar and Contact, but here it's at least so ridiculous. It's kind of fun, but just wow.
Okay, so Rachel and I are going to tackle this together because this is actually one of our dislikes.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to do this narrative style, Rachel. You ready?
Sure. So,
'cause I suspect if people are listening to this and have never watched the movie, they have no idea what you're talking about, David.
Sorry.
And that's okay. I just think we need to explain how absolutely fucking ridiculous this ending scene is. Not least of all because it makes no sense, even though it's trying desperately to be super smart. So, in any case, we have our peoples, right? And they're fighting and da-da-da, and the ship's going to fall into the black hole, and then they get into the little pod, right? And they go through the black hole. And what happens when they're in the black hole is they have these weird flashbacks to various things that they have said or felt or whatever while being on, like, what I can only describe as, like, whatever vehicle at the carnival they designed to make people throw up. Because it just goes... It does, right?
Yeah, no, it's like they're in the Tilt-A-Whirl.
Yes. Yeah, and it just goes around and around, and like we follow them. Like, it's really cheap, for one. Anyway, so they fall through this thing, and they're having these weird audio flashbacks, and then, poo, we come through it. And it is our dude who's supposed to be dead, Hans, what's his balls?
Reinhardt,
right? And so he's there, and he's like, oh, he's looking around. He's like floating through the space first, and then he lands on the little thing, right? No, he floats through space, and then Max, the robot comes.
And then Maximilian, like, comes swooping in, and I don't know, they like, have, like, weird robot sex and merge. And
right,
then they go
do.
To space hell, because everyone knows that is against the word of God.
Right, so they go to space hell, which has, like, you know, it's got rocks and stuff and fire, and, like, the humanoid robot-y things are, like, walking in single file. Like marching on whatever, and he's like trapped inside the robot because when they merged, they became like one together, because that's of course how a sexual union with a robot would work, right?
Well, yeah,
obviously, right? Like, you wouldn't become distinct beings, you would just sort of be subsumed inside of the robot through copulation. Yeah,
he went inside the robot. Well, and the thing that bothered me the most about space hell was just, you know, obviously what you would expect to find at the center of a black hole is a bunch of fire.
And naturally.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of oxygen there that's just fallen down the black hole. And then you start getting, like, after we see space hell and a long shot of space hell and Maximilian Reinhardt thing, like, standing on Bald Mountain, basically, surrounded by the flames of space hell, then you start getting, like, the shiny corridor.
Right.
And
the fallopian tube of space.
Yeah, and someone in a white robe just runs down it, and then we're back in the Tilt-A-Whirl.
Well, it doesn't run down it. She, like, floats
like
a ghost.
Yeah, her eyes and her clothes are all flowy. And
through the fallopian tube of space.
So basically, are you saying that she's like a sperm?
They're all birds.
It's space heaven because it's stained glass windows. It's the vault, the Gothic arches that we go through in slow motion for the Ave Maria in Fantasia.
Well, but
oh my God, you're right,
it also
yeah.
fits that there is, like, if we think of the Max and Reinhardt as having their weird robot human union, which would symbolically make sense for the movie if the movie was trying desperately to actually make this work, but it doesn't, right? That this also would have its own sort of reproductive mythology behind it, which is they're birthed out of the canal of space stained glass.
Space vagina. The space vagina.
I mean, I don't mind the I actually kind of have, I can sort of run, since this is where the film was wanting to go, that we just go on to the full on metaphysical, that it really, that the black hole is the passage to heaven and hell. You know, they hint that way in some of Reinhardt's more portentous dialogue early on. And so we see his punishment, though apparently Maximilian's as well. And then we see our heroes get out through, you know, divine intervention the other way. And it just, so okay, fine, if that's the way you're gonna go, I'll try to go with that. But to so, baldly and perfunctorily, crib one of your other movies, feels so half-assed, I guess. It's so shameless, I almost admire it, but it's just done so quickly that I'm wondering why, you know, it's like they just gave up and walked away.
That's fair.
Well, and I mean, what kind of, I just, it was already like this slow pace and frankly, I felt exceedingly pretentious movie. And this was just like, you know, the snooty icing on the pretentiousness cake. And I was just really done with it. And I will also give you this, by the way, this quote from my lovely roommate who said, I'd have to have 3 joints before watching this.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Do you think we've covered it, Rachel?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, then I think we need to go to our third likes, which I'm going to start with you, Julia.
Okay. So this is I said I was going to mention another robot thing. This is 2 out of 3. The second one is Rachel described him as a blender Cylon, but I took to calling him Sir KitchenAid because he really looked like a stand mixer with his attachment that then mixed people to death. And I really kind of loved / was horrified by the evisceration of Anthony Perkins.
Disney celebrating its first PG rating.
Yes. Is this movie was the first Disney PG-rated movie for that death scene and for the use of Helen Dam.
That's just sad.
Yes. But yeah, so Sir KitchenAid's little whirly attachment and the way that he used it, like, they showed it and they telegraphed it earlier, and I was like, they're never going to go there, though. It's fine. And then they went there, and I was like, whoa. And can I just say Anthony Perkins' performance when he's like, whoa, la, la. Like, not only his intestines, but his tongue are being whirled.
It's like they couldn't figure out, how would this scene really go? Just make some strange noises.
We don't want to make it bloody. We don't want to scare the kids too much. But
so give him a big fat book to hold in front of his chest.
And then just make
the
a noise.
There so that you can see that the robot is really drilling through.
Yeah.
Because, like, those pages get, like, tufted up into the air. You just don't have to see any, like, actual gross entrails.
Which would have been more interesting.
But, yeah, Death by KitchenAid, it's a pretty bold move.
It was, like, the most animated that character was in the entire film was when he was getting mixed to death.
Do you think he has other attachments?
Well,
I mean, because, like, Reinhard is there, but, like, he's by himself.
There was the robo-sex in space hell, so I don't know.
Well, that would finally explain that mysterious bit of dialogue where he says, protect me from Maximilian, and don't know why.
Oh, God! It's true! It's, like, never explained, and it would have been really interesting.
His attachments are too big.
Can I say something here?
Go for it, Paul.
Okay, I've been quiet a while and quietly sulking, but okay. The reason why, in my opinion, because I've seen this movie enough times, yes, I know, pity me, fear me, hate me, whatever. Anyway, the reason why Reinhardt goes with that dialogue, and the reason why we see what we see in Hell is, this is a motif of the Frankenstein story.
Yeah.
Maximilian has created this robot, Maximilian. Reinhardt's created this robot, Maximilian. I mean, they talk about him being superior to STAR and all that. And this is the classic case of the createe being exceeding the creator. So he's afraid of his own creation, and it's kind of hinted throughout the movie at Lainley that he doesn't have full control over Maximilian. So, protect me from Maximilian. I think Reinhardt's kind of like, he might be trying to game Dr. Frey a little bit, but I think he's realizing that Maximilian's really slipping out of Reinhardt's grasp. And so when we finally get to Hell, Maximilian basically subsumes his creator inside of himself. He exceeds his creator by taking his creator inside of himself, and that's why we get the Reinhardt inside Maximilian in the hell scene. So that may go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say it also fitting in with what you're just saying is the extra diegetic bit of information that Maximilian is also the name of the actor playing Reinhardt.
Exactly. Which just makes it all this more interesting. So yeah, so Maximilian is definitely greater than Reinhardt intended, and it is his doom and his damnation at the end.
And okay. He is a pretty cool robot.
So I will just say that while I agree that I think that was the intent that they were trying for, I think it is very poorly set up.
Yeah.
Which is my issue with it, because this film could have really good symbolic sort of metaphorical resonances, but I feel like what it tries to go for these things, but then they kind of come across sort of like haphazardly. So that scene in particular for me, right, you know, they've had this bad moment where Maximilian kills this dude, and like it seems like he doesn't have control of him, and so he comes up and he says, "Save me from Maximilian," and blah, 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 and then it like just goes back to normal. He just starts barking orders again, and it just doesn't seem to come to anything from that moment. And so for me, it was very confusing, because it's like I feel like that's what they're trying to go for, what you were describing, Paul. But in the film, it just comes off as desperation. He's just like trying desperately to have somebody he can continue to manipulate. But
he's looking for a lifeline, yeah.
Yeah, and it just doesn't. I wanted that to work, but they just didn't set it up for me. It was not enough to set up that idea, because I feel like that could have been really interesting if it had been set up. But in any case, who has actually gone? It's just Julia, right?
For the likes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, David, why don't you go?
Well, I have to admire the casting decisions, you know. So here's Disney. Hey, kids, who do you want to see? You want to see the stars from 20 years ago. So here you go. Leads from the Time Machine, from Judgment at Nuremberg, from Marty, from Psycho, the voice from Planet of the Apes. It's an extraordinarily mature cast, like Alec Guinness multiplied, to go with Yvette Mimieux, Anthony Perkins, Maximilian Schell, Ernest Borgnine. That's striking in 1979.
Okay, all right. Paul, did you do your like it?
No, but I'll just say Maximilian and we'll just move on.
Oh, you like Maximilian.
Paul, no, you love this movie. You should tell us why you love it.
Yeah, she's right.
The three of you dislike it. David is probably at least middling. No, Maximilian, let's move on.
Well,
Maximilian is awesome. I'm with you there.
Julia's like was Maximilian.
Yeah, no, why you like...
No, I'm just talking about the movie in general. So now, Mac, you described it. You described the scene in perfect detail, Julia, which is the epitome of Maximilian. So let's move on.
All righty, Rachel.
All right. So, I was kind of horribly amused by the Robo Dick waving contest between Vincent and Maximilian. They're like having this stare down, and it's like Blender Cylon versus South Park R2-D2. And it was ridiculous because the design on those two robots is so incongruous. It was like, you know, Mickey Mouse trying to stare down Voldemort.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Now I got confused. I thought you were talking about the let's shoot lasers at dots scene.
No. So that was another Robo Dick waving contest. And that one was also very entertaining for exactly the same reason, because once again, it was kind of like Mickey Mouse shooting or Mickey Mouse challenging Lord Voldemort to a shooting contest. But it's just anytime Vincent goes up against any of the other robots and he's being like, my Robocock is bigger than your Robocock, it's fucking ridiculous because he's like a little cartoonish floating ball of metal.
But as he keeps saying, and as Bob says, right, we're the best.
Yeah, well, and his Robocock is obviously much more effective than Maximilian's or what's his butts, because he manages to, like, penetrate the shit out of Maximilian and shoot the other guy, so the mime in a terrible costume. So, obviously his Robocock is superior, but he looks like he's from fucking South Park. And I'm not sure how I feel about this, but it's really funny.
Yeah, okay. All right. All right, well, shall we go to, I guess we're on third dislikes. So Rachel and I believe are out for this round because we've already hit our third. So Paul, why don't we go to your third?
All right. Dr. McCrae is a poorly drawn character in this film. She doesn't have much to do besides ESP for Vincent, and once she finds out her father is dead, she's very much damselized for the remainder of the film. She doesn't have any agency. She, at that point, she winds up having to get rescued. And of course, the movie doesn't pass the Bechdel tests because there are no other female characters. There are presumably female robots underneath those clothes, but we don't actually get to have her interact with any of them. All the robots are male, which is a point. So while the other male characters all have defined roles, even if they are sometimes cast from central casting, poor Dr. McCrae just gets to be Uhura in effect, to talk to Vincent via ESP, and that's what she does, and that's all she can do, and that is a major disappointment.
Aww. Fair enough. Okay. David?
The dialogue is cringe-inducing. Two of my favorites are when we learned that the mission of the Palomino is to find habitable life. Okay, what, they're looking for gigantic space whales to establish a colony on? I'm not quite sure what that means. I think my favorite is when Anthony Perkins tells Maximilian Schell, you will be remembered as one of the greatest space scientists of all time. So actually going there to call him a space scientist, that's Lost Skeleton of Cadaver quality dialogue there.
I will say that clearly what they were looking for was Discworld.
Okay, there we go. Yes, habitable life.
Fair. Yeah, some of the dialogue is kind of But, you know, it's not the worst. We've had worse dialogue for this show.
No, that's true. That's true.
So, all right, Julia, third dislike.
I'm going to agree with Paul. While it's cool that they actually bothered to have a female astronaut, I mean, yay, that's exciting. She does, like, really quickly loses all character and is just kind of a lump who is there to be rescued later in the film. And it's sad because it starts off with, like, maybe she could have a story, she could have an arc, she could wonder what happened to her father. She doesn't actually get to do any of those things. We did wonder if she was the inspiration for Deanna Troi, because she does her ESP for Vincent. She's like, I'm sensing people on that ship. And I was like, oh.
You're right, Julia. She is a model for Deanna Troi.
Except it only seems to apply to robots.
No, she says
humans on this.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, she senses them, but she can only communicate. Her ESP communication only applies to inanimate objects, which is weird.
Yes. So, the thing is, like that thing where she senses humans on the ship is especially frustrating because she senses humans, plural, on that ship. They get to the ship. The only person there is Reinhardt. And she has all the keys to be investigating what the hell is going on. And she doesn't actually do anything with it. No. She takes it at face value when he says, your dad's dead. She never questions that the robots are people. She never looks for the other humans that she's apparently sensed. But like when she's on the ship, apparently she can't sense them anymore. They're gone. I don't know.
It is a major plot hole, Julia. You're correct. She should have followed it up.
I found it very frustrating that she could have been a cool character and they just didn't do anything with her.
I was not as bothered by the ESP thing, mostly because it became clear to me that the robots are played off here as being sentient mechanical beings. And while obviously there's kind of a loophole somewhere in there that doesn't quite get explained, I just felt like it wasn't that big a leap to be like, oh, well, she could have ESP with a robot. It just didn't seem that unusual. Of all the things in this film that don't quite work, that one just didn't bug me. The fact that she doesn't use it very much, except at a couple key points in the plot, which to me seems kind of absurd, because you would think that she would be talking with Vincent while he's off doing, you know, gallivanting and with Bob, right? But she doesn't until almost the very end. Well, Rachel?
And I was going to say, and the fact that she's psychic, but she can apparently only talk to robots?
It's just not explained, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she... They say she is...
Assumed that people couldn't... That other people hadn't developed their ESP and couldn't talk back to her. So while she could sense them and maybe sense their emotions, she couldn't actually mind communicate with them, but robots could because they weren't human and they understood how to do that without talking.
Well, Vincent talks about robots being programmed to do ESP messages. So apparently you could program a robot to do that sort of thing.
So there you go. Answered. Sweet. I think we have hit every third dislike, so we can go to fourth like, yeah?
Yep.
Alrighty. David, fourth like.
There were a couple of unexpected twists. This follows on, I think, for my other like about the casting, is that we have Anthony Perkins and he's being the cold, unemotional scientist drawn in by Reinhardt's glorious theories and so on and so forth. And given that it's Anthony Perkins who, ever since breaking out of being typecast as a romantic lead with Psycho, was then a villain forever after. You're waiting for him to betray the rest of the crew, and so when it's Ernest Borgnine, who's been agitating and about being suspicious about Reinhardt and motivations and all this from the beginning, when he's the one who turns out to be the coward and almost gets them all killed, whereas Perkins we see remains true to honest principles all the way up until his death. That was actually kind of unexpected. I'd completely forgotten about that. It had been a while since I'd seen the movie, and so I was surprised again when those characters didn't play out the way I was expecting them to.
I do just want to add that Ernest Borgnine's character inadvertently saves them.
Yes, and they mention it in the film itself.
Yeah, because if you recall, right, he pretends to get his leg broken while there's being a laser battle going on. I don't know how he broke his leg, but apparently the young whippersnapper kid's not that bright. And so then when the kid runs off, what does he do? He runs inside the ship, he gets in the ship, but we've already learned at that point that Evil Genius Doctor is going to blow up the ship as soon as it's launched. As soon as it's far enough away that it would not be a problem. While he is a coward, he actually saves their lives in his cowardice. So in a weird way, he is a hero.
True enough.
Or maybe not quite a hero, but like an accidental hero.
Yeah.
He's a useful fool.
There you go. Useful fool. And he does, unveil some information throughout the film, which I thought was interesting because I always kind of assumed as soon as Ernest Borgnine showed up, I was like, he's just going to be a buffoon through the whole movie. He's just going to be kind of like saying vaguely useful things that are not really that useful, but are kind of like make people feel good. That kind of buffoon.
He has his instincts.
Right.
Yeah, and he's positioned for the first, right up until the third act. There is that thing about, he's rather mercenary about just yanking everyone back so we can all be heroes. So, we get an early sign that, well, wait a minute, he's not entirely ethical. But for the most part, he feels like, he's one of our principal heroes here. So, yeah, again, when his fate and Perkins' fate are not what their casting would lead us to believe, at least would lead me to believe, I found that nice.
Interesting. Okay. Julia, why don't you give us your fourth?
Okay, so my fourth like is, again, going to be something that people have already kind of touched on, and that's the Cygnus, which is really cool. And it looks really cool when we first see it, and then it lights up, and it looks really cool, and we get to go inside it and see all sorts of things. And I know that, like, most of them are really, really implausible, but how cool is that garden? It's very cool that he actually has his garden in space and can... come up with all sorts of fresh vegetables and flowers and has his classy dining room with crystal chandeliers and stuff. And I don't know. I really enjoyed it. The Cygnus was a good set. It, clearly, a lot of their money went into making that set.
Yeah.
But where did all this stuff come from?
What, the mushrooms and everything else?
Don't question it. Don't question it.
Well, like his fancy chandeliers and his cool table and the resources.
Like, he obviously brought that up into space with him.
Like he got the tax. He got the taxpayers to foot the bill. I mean, Harry Booth, Aries Moroni, points out his fact this is the costless fiasco of all time. So yeah, so Dr. Reinhardt convinced them to outfit the ship in lavish style because of his crazy personal charm and his genius.
Huh.
There we go.
I mean, it's a very good...
Well, and it wasn't just for him. It was for all the other crew. And in theory, the ship would have gone out many times. So it would have been like, you know, your luxury exploration ship that people would spend a long time on. So having a nice formal dining room that they got to spend time in seems good.
I mean, it's nice. I just don't...
It's very much at odds with the Palomino. And it's meant to be at odds with the Palomino, aesthetically and otherwise. The Palomino is very, very utilitarian.
Right, it's economical.
Economical. The Cygnus is everything opposite of that.
It's excess.
I sort of wondered, like, if the Palomino was so utilitarian and small because the taxpayers had paid all this money to make the lavish Cygnus, which is supposed to be, you know, their flagship out there being awesome in space, and then it just disappears and no one ever hears of it again. And it's like, oh, well, we're not going to put our money behind that kind of expense anymore.
I think that's the implication.
Huh. Well, okay then. All right. Well, Paul, you're next. Your fourth like.
My fourth like. Okay. You all hated him, but I like Vincent. Okay, maybe not his physical design. I like him as a character.
I can get behind that. Yeah.
Because, well, yes. I mean, the whole hiding of the eyes, his butting heads with Maximilian, his quoting of Cicero. Are you programmed to bug me? No, sir. To educate you. He forges a relationship with Bob. And he saves the day. I mean, that fight with Maximilian is pants. But consider how it started, because I've seen this movie too many bloody fucking times to so I can quote a chapter and verse. Because they're running through the courtyard, they're going through the catwalk, and then Maximilian shows up. What does Vincent do? Vincent goes to sacrifice himself, pinning Maximilian against the wall long enough for everybody else to escape. So he's willing to sacrifice himself for the rest of the crew. I mean, the fact that he wins is kind of improbable because Maximilian is way out of his weight class, as Dr. Reinhardt says, David and Goliath, but this time David is overmatched. I'm not sure the drill should have worked to beat Maximilian when the lasers wouldn't do anything. But he does it anyway. He's got heart and he's voice, and yes, I know it's from 20 years ago, David, but he's got the voice of Ronnie McDowell.
Yeah.
So yes, I know, looking at R2-D2 and looking at him, I was like, where the heck is Vincent? Vincent looks old and not very well designed as far as a movie prop. I know. But still, I like him as a
character. He was my first like, though, Paul. He was my very first like.
I know. I'm getting defensive on the movie again. I shouldn't do that. I apologize. So.
You're in my position when you all ripped my childhood to pieces.
I did mention this is going to be my Mac and me, and it is. So there you go. But okay, I'm going to, I might as well explain it at this point in the movie because I didn't know where to explain it. But it's not even the movie itself, because before I saw the first of all movie, I didn't see it in the movie theaters because, as I told you, I didn't see a movie in a movie theater until 1983. And before I actually got to see this movie on television, I was given the illustrated storybook of this movie, like around 1980 or so. Remember those? No one remembers that. Bueller? No.
Not the photo novel, but,
Not the photo novel, not the four part comic, the illustrated storybook.
Okay.
Oh yeah, the read along. The read-along with the pictures.
With the 45
actually,
RPM?
That comes up for me a little later.
Okay. Then I'll hold off talking about that right now because you're going to talk about that. So, okay.
Actually, go ahead. Just I'll get it out of the way now. Go ahead and talk about it.
Okay, so this is why I got this first before I ever saw the movie. So I got to read this over and over again, and I liked it. It's like, this is awesome. Why can't I see this movie? Oh, because it was out in theaters a couple years ago, and I finally got to see it on the theater on the screen. And this was my first indication that storybooks and movies could be different. And there are differences. I'm not sure if I should go into those differences or not. What do you think, Julia?
What I want to say about this is that I did not have this storybook, but Moss had read this storybook, and he doesn't remember if he had it or if it was at a friend's house or what. But we ended up looking it up online and actually reading the storybook online because he had this. He was like, "I know I have read this storybook," because he hadn't seen the movie and he would have remembered seeing that movie. Like, it's very distinctive. But he was like, "But I know these characters. I know this story." And the really interesting difference that we found was that, like, when the movie ended, and this goes back to my earlier plot kvetching, is that the movie ended and I was like, wait, what? It just ended? That was it? There's nothing, like, no resolution. It just ended. Okay. And Moss was like, yeah, but we looked at the storybook, and the last page of the storybook has a very different ending. It says, "Suddenly, everything was calm. They had come through safely. Before them stretched a giant universe filled with planets and stars that had been swallowed by the black hole. Kate was stunned. What will we do now? Well, we can't go back," replied the captain. "But that's no reason to give up hope. We've been trained to find new worlds. Let's go find one for ourselves." And I was like, holy crap, that book had way better resolution than the movie. So, yeah, that was one of the big differences, and I'm happy to hear the other ones if you want to go into them, Paul.
Yeah, that was the big one I was going to mention, that, yeah, they don't go through the heaven and hell at all. The way the Cygnus gets hit by meteors, just like in the movie, but it basically cripples and presumed goes into the black hole and gets destroyed in the process, and so Maximilian and Reinhardt and everyone else on the Cygnus just go down and die, and they don't get through. There's a couple. There's others. The laser dogfight scene between the Vincent and Star. We actually get to see a scoreboard. Actually, you could see how well Vincent actually did in the storybook. It shows a scoreboard we never see in the actual movie. There's a line of dialogue when Booth takes a Palomino. I think it's Pizer and says, "That rack Booth, he's deserted us." Never say that in the movie. And there's also a line about the actors are leaking hydrogen, Dr. McCrae says at one point. So there's small little differences here and there that make it a distinctly different movie, different story. But that was the story I got first. I mean, the movie didn't quite match up with that, but I loved that book to death.
Do you want to know what the Alan Dean Foster novelization of the film, how that ends?
Yes. Yes,
they're all fused together. So Kate is calling to them to join her as they're all being sort of crushed or something. So it ends that they blended, flowed together, thought itself strained beyond its normal borders until the unimaginable force of the collapsar. Then they were through and amazingly still whole. Kate was Kate. Charlie and Dan Holland still Dan Holland. Even Vincent was there. They were themselves, and yet something strange and new, a galactic sea change that produced all the above and a new unified mind thing that was Kate, Charlie, Dan, Vincent also. Dimly, it perceived the final annihilation of a minuscule agglutination of refined masses, the Palomino, and so on. They had been compressed, compacted, but had passed through and beyond and through with their selves still intact. On a beach was a grain of sand. The sand was part of a continent, the continent a component of a world, the world a speck of substance in the sea of infinity. They were part of that world, part of every world. For in passing out the white hole, their substance had become dispersed, an atom of Charlie to a nine-world system, a molecule of Kate to a local cluster of stars, a tiny diffuse section of Holland spread thin over a dozen galaxies. yet they could still think, for thought does not respect the trifling limitations of time and space. They were still them and this new thing they had become, spread substance, and they now had an eternity in. Their thoughts spanned infinity, as did their final... There's massive typos here. It's almost unreadable. they now had an eternity in which to contemplate the universe they had become.
That's fascinating.
That's even
okay.
Weirder.
So that is amazing. I have to say that. So one of the podcasts I occasionally listen to is
The
Book Was Better.
Yes,
where they read the novelization of the film and then they decide whether the novelization of the film or the film was better. And I have to say, in this case, both the picture book and this one that you've just read from are definitely better endings than what we got in the movie.
I should suggest that they do these.
Yes. Well, there's also a little golden book, and now I'm really curious as to see what that has. Because the little golden book is The Black Hole, A Space Adventure for Robots.
Wait, you mean like the little kids book golden book with the golden binding?
Yeah, like the little golden books. Yep.
Oh my God, that's adorable.
Wow.
Wow, okay. Who has not given a like? Me?
Have I?
I don't know, man.
I don't think either you or Rachel has.
I think David and everyone else just kind of like wiped our minds.
I've got one.
Go for it, Rachel.
I like that there is a literal tinfoil hat in this movie.
Where?
When what's her butt, the psychic, is going to get turned into a robot. They put a tinfoil hat on her and wrap her in, like, a condom.
Wait, what?
Oh, yes, when she's kidnapped. Yes.
Oh, right, okay. I thought you mean to protect her from... Okay, I got really confused.
Well, it's like they've wrapped her in a body condom so she can't move and put a tinfoil hat on her and then stuck her in, like, those molds and so they're going to laser her brain or whatever. And there's... a tinfoil hat. So I like that.
Okay. Fair enough. I guess I should go to then mine. Yeah? I don't think I said this before, but though I think the film doesn't execute well, I actually really liked the premise. And that may be because I saw Event Horizon first. And I appreciate the kind of the cosmic horror that the black hole can represent. And here I think it's intended to be so, this kind of unknown thing. I think Event Horizon kind of goes to sort of really brings in the hellish sort of humanity into it. But this one I think tries to do something a little bit different. I like the premise. I don't think it's executed well, but I think that what they started with was really interesting and could have been really interesting. In fact, if they had just had what David, like a visual representation of what David just read to us, I feel like this film would be like one of the most fascinating science fiction film of the 70s. I don't know how you would visually represent that, David, but.
Yeah, nor do I, but I wonder, if this is a case with Alan Dean Foster just sort of looking at the script and going, no, I'm going to do this instead. I don't know.
I feel like that's pretty normal for Alan Dean Foster based on, as Julia mentioned, the Book Was Better has covered a couple Alan Dean Foster versions.
I also think that from what I've heard from a lot of people who have done media tie-in books like that, a lot of times what happens is you're handed a script in some level of development before the movie is actually finished production and you don't get to see the finished film and you have like maybe 2 weeks to write a novel. So here's your word count and this is the rough idea of what happens. And maybe there are a few things that you have to put in there that it's like, this must happen. But other than that, it's like, fill up this amount of words. Go.
Yeah. And that's why in his novelization of Alien, there are some scenes in there that don't appear in the film, but that were going to. And I think some of them might even have shown up in the...
The director's cut, yeah.
Well, it's not a director's cut, but the recut, the version that came out.
The final director's cut?
No, that you're talking about Blade Runner there.
I just know there's like a version of Aliens that is.
It was called of Alien. The thing that came out a few years ago was called the director's cut, but even Ridley Scott says no, it's not. That was just as far as he's concerned, the director's cut is the theatrical release of '79. He just agreed to rearrange some stuff for the re-release. But there are some scenes in the novelization that aren't in the film, but that were certainly going to be. And I think that the biggest split between tie-in novel and a film is the novelization for Phantom of the Paradise, which has no supernatural elements whatsoever, which are a pretty important part of the movie.
Yeah.
So David, when I have, written a novel and it's one day turned into a movie and they do a novelization, will you write that?
Absolutely.
Cool. Cause I know you can write a novel in like 3 days, which is probably the deadline they'll give you. So
I'll get right on that.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. You can take your liberties with it. Cause I don't actually care if it's like the movie, cause the movie will probably be like, I don't know, whoever did the Twilight films. Cause at that point, I don't have any control. Actually, it'll most likely be Michael Bay, even though I'll have it in my contract that I will not allow that, but whatever. So, shall we go to our fourth dislike? I think that's where we are, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
Yes, we are.
I think so. Okay. Julia, we'll start with you.
Okay, so the flip side of my Cygnus like is that there were just so many corridors. So many. So much footage of people moving on a very slow vehicle down a corridor for no reason. Sometimes being struck by nerds' candy.
God.
But yeah, like I really wanted to like the vehicles too, because they kind of reminded me of the Omni Movers that you'll get on Disneyland rides. I really wanted to be like, I want to go on the black hole ride. That looks like it would be fun. And instead I was just sort of like, no, this is just really, really slow moving down a corridor. Why are we watching this?
What about like the little, like the people mover they have?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. The little Omni Mover vehicle thing.
I'm just trying to remember when what's his butt was riding on it and he was like trying to stop so he could look at the robots. It's like, why? I'm trying to hit the brakes. Why isn't it stopping? And then it like slowly comes to a halt. It was a very odd scene.
Yeah, Logan's Run
had
better
shuttles.
It's not stopping
because it's basically a Disneyland vehicle from a ride, and you don't have control over those.
It does look like a ride they wanted to build that never happened, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like they didn't give us anything good to put in the ride, so that's probably why that ride didn't happen.
I feel like a black hole.
Paul,
ride
I see
could
you have
cool.
your hand up.
Yeah. It's completely unrelated to this, but okay. I have to make a giant correction. It wasn't the illustrated storybook that I had read when I was young, because I just found that and no, that wasn't it. It was actually, I know there was a 4-issue comic. It was apparently, yeah, I only had the one thing. I was issue number 2 of the 4. That's the only one I had, because I found that online and I'm looking at it like, yes, this is it. This is that. Or maybe I had 1 and 2, but yeah, no, it's number two. Yep, the robot force is routed, but before Holland can lead his little army back to the Palomino, she's blasting off! That rat booth, he's leaving us! Yeah, so I found it. No, it was the issue number 2 of the 4-issue comic. That's the only part I had of the movie. I didn't even realize until now that I missed half the movie in the comic, because it starts off with, because they go through extra stuff. I mean, the robots show off the conversion scene. I'm looking at this now. Where the people can convert into robots, where we're just talking about, Dr. McCrae. The robots get to see that a little extra. We get to see other things too. So yeah, that's what I actually had. That's what I had before I actually saw the movie, was one issue of this comic. So that's even weirder and more random. I'm sorry. That was completely breaking the flow of the podcast, but I thought I had to had to set the record straight.
You are an honorable man, Paul, but since you are talking, why don't you go to your fourth dislike?
My fourth dislike. Okay. Because the comic is a better version of it, the shooting gallery scene in this movie does not work very well. it's not executed very well. We don't get a really good sense of how they keep score or how it goes. Oh, you would have beat him if you missed on purpose. No, but that's never actually really clear. And the game itself looks like pants. And it's such an important part of the movie because Star gets shot and that leads to Vincent and Bob to start shooting robots and starting this uprising of a sort. That, yeah, it's a very bad thing. I mean, it starts off fine with Vincent being dismissive of the company of other robots, but the actual execution of that scene itself is, I mean, we already talked about the pacing problems of this movie. Yeah, it just doesn't work. I know it's a small thing compared to the large, huge things that you all dislike about this movie, but yeah, this is one small thing that doesn't work for me. So there you are.
Fair enough, Paul. Well, why don't we jump to you, Rachel?
All right, so how about the fact that when Reinhardt is having his super fancy dinner with the chandeliers, he's wearing this red, like, tunic and trousers combo and, like, a medal around his neck that is quite evocative of what I think an Iron Cross. And I was like, really? You know, we're going to Reinhardt and he's German and okay. I just thought it was very clumsy and it made me roll my eyes.
Okay. Iron Cross not working for you, huh?
No, it was just, you know, oh, well, it's easy to make a German a villain basically, or, you know, I don't know. It just, I there was so much in the movie that I thought was very ham-handed, and yeah, that to me that was just kind of one of those moments where I was like, really? Come on.
He really should have had a pipe organ though, because he is missing that.
Oh my god, he should have been like playing for them as they came into the room, and it would have been perfect.
Gosh, that would have been cool.
I mean, yeah. I was digging his you know his Grandpa Wolverine beard. I don't know.
Kept growing through the rest of his career, as far as I can tell. So when he's, because doesn't he still have it when he and when he's getting killed on the beach in Deep Impact?
He killed him. Actually, is that the same guy?
Yeah, Maximilian Schell.
Yeah.
Oh my god, he does have the beard, and he hugs Tia Leone. And then they get massacred by a giant wave. Yeah.
For no good reason.
For no good reason, because they both could have gotten like a fucking helicopter or some shit. It's whatever.
Yeah.
Total waste. But whatevs. So, I guess I should go to mine. And I'm just going to say that the editing for this film is incredibly sloppy. I noticed a number of instances when we would get, you know, cut from one thing to another, and then the scene that it's cutting back to has had a transition of some kind, but there's no sense to it. So, like, the really obvious example is when the Cygnus is falling into the black hole, and we see one scene where it is pretty far from the black hole. It hasn't actually gone anywhere close to the actual hole. And then we cut to, like, the characters, I don't know, like, sitting down and talking to each other or something. And then we cut back, and there's no indication that any real time has gone by except maybe, like, 10 seconds. And it's gone. The Cygnus is completely and utterly gone. When there was no indication that it was moving at such a rate that it would be gone. We never see it actually moving so fast or actually being sucked into the black hole. And there are just a lot of instances of this where the film sort of cuts and scenes change. Things are missing from the scene. There's scenes when, like, Maximilian is in one scene and then in another he's not there when he should be there. I had an issue with that because it just seemed like this is Disney. Like, this should not exist in this film. Like, the editing should be at least reasonable. Despite all of the other aspects. So it's not a funny dislike, but it is a dislike. And I think we've hit all the dislikes for
the round. I haven't done mine yet.
Oh, David, go.
Even though I loved the main theme, there are some disappointing moments in John Barry's score, particularly during the action scenes. The music is weirdly stodgy and kills the momentum there. And this is from a guy who did the score for every James Bond movie from Dr. No to The Living Daylights. So that struck me as really odd. Made for very flat combat scenes.
Are you talking about the moment when the score seems to like change the style entirely?
Yeah, it's almost like this. It's like it anticipates Indiana Jones in a bad way. There's just this kind of dun dun dun, dun triumphant music when it's supposed to be suspenseful. Yeah. And it's just weird and out of place. Now, I mean, maybe I shouldn't blame Barry for that entirely, but there are it's just striking when the music is so good for its main purpose. Then when we get to the action scenes, it just doesn't work at all.
I blame that on the editing and the direction.
That's certainly a big part of it. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah,
I just feel like that they completely miss the tone. But I'll come back to something related to that later. So shall we go to our last likes, guys?
Okay.
All right. We'll start with you, Paul, because you love this film, so I want to give you the first go.
Okay, well, my last like is, okay, cue eye rolls, everybody, Dr. Reinhardt. He is such an over-the-top villain, but he's got that mad genius. I mean, he's not always executed perfectly. The script doesn't quite know what to do with him sometimes, but he's Maximilian Schnell, for crying out loud, and he's got a mad idea to try to get a ship into the black hole and be a mad genius and manipulate people around him with this strange charisma and build a robot that's better than he is in some ways. It subsumes him. He's an intense, he's an overtop scenery chewing character that I kind of like him as a villain every time he's on the screen. He knows how to charm. He knows how to charm the scientist and try to get Dr. McCrae on his side. And then when things start going wrong, he'll do anything to try to survive. And it's like, nope. The whole getting crushed by the giant flat screen TV. And he looks so pathetic there, but it's just like, that's a fitting end for you. But no, it's going to get worse once you get into the black hole. And he lies to Trump. He could have not lied, for example, about the garden. He could have said, oh yes, the garden's big because I like it that way. But no, he thinks he can get away with everything because he thinks he's the smartest man in the room. And to an extent he is, but that proves his undoing in the end. Inventing robots, power supplies, and anti-gravity, he being the smartest man in the room isn't enough. And hubris is his fatal flaw, and this movie shows once and for all of the problem of the fatal fall of hubris. It illustrates it exactly in the character of Dr. Reinhardt.
Is it really hubris, though? Because he says repeatedly.
It's so hubris.
But he says repeatedly that he has no interest in being recognized for what he's done. I mean, the what's his name from Psycho, that dude, repeatedly says, like, well, like, if we take this stuff back, like, you'll be remembered and you'll be able to do anything you want and you'll have all of this honor. And he says, I don't give a shit.
No, because he's going for apotheosis. Isn't that the very epitome of hubris? He's trying to become God or a God or merge with God. That is hubris of the first order, Sean.
I guess. I feel
like.
I would
agree with that.
I just think he's kind of normal.
You know some very strange people and you think Dr. Reinhardt's a normal, Sean.
If I was as smart as him, that would be what I would do. I wouldn't want any of the honor. I would just be like, I've got an opportunity here. Let's just see what happens.
And if it wasn't
so he kind of reminded me of Duran Duran from Barbarella.
What the hell?
That's random, Julia.
Oh my god, that's going on Twitter.
Well, he's got that same kind of. Yeah, and I see what you mean.
Go ahead, Julie. Explain yourself.
Well, have you actually seen Barbarella?
I have not.
Okay, so Duran Duran, the band, is named after the evil scientist Duran Duran in the movie Barbarella. And he's very much an over-the-top campy evil scientist, and I kind of can see how Paul would like Dr. Reinhardt for that, because he has kind of the same vibe going on, except that Duran Duran has a sex machine that he wants to kill Jane Fonda with.
Except she kills the sex machine.
Yep, she's just insatiable. Barbarella is a very special movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is classic.
Like, that's only one little tiny piece of it, but there are many, many things that go on in Barbarella.
It starts out with a zero-G striptease.
It's different.
Zero-G in quote marks, you know, zero-G.
Microgravity.
Yes.
With zero-G credits.
Okay, but we're not here to talk about Barbarella, so I just wanted to throw that out there that I can see how you would like the campy over-the-topness of Reinhardt. He reminded me of Duran Duran, and I can see that.
God, guys, you guys are crazy.
He's also full-on Captain Nemo. And
yes, Captain Nemo is another good parallel.
Okay.
Captain Nemo, Frankenstein. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we need to move on so we can try to get this done at 10 p.m. so that I can sober up for what will be another recording. So why don't we jump to who is left? Everybody's left because Paul's the only one who's gone.
Yeah.
So Rachel.
Sorry. Are we on likes or dislikes?
We are on likes.
Last like.
Last like. Okay.
Come up with something.
All I've got left is that I think the swirly black hole effect, which Sean keeps referring to as his space anus, was actually quite pretty. His space anus is the most beautiful space anus I've seen that wasn't in Interstellar. That was a space anus.
It was a pretty space anus.
Chris Nolan's space anus has destroyed all other space anuses, but until then, the one from the black hole is pretty nice looking.
Well, I will say that Chris Nolan really knows how to handle a space anus.
Oh, God, this is getting to the end.
We're approximately 5 years old.
We are, but I don't care.
Is someone tweeting that?
Like, Chris Nolan really knows how to handle a space anus.
I am. I'll
tweet feel it. Like that is a quotable tweet.
It is a quotable tweet. So while you guys talk, I'm going to tweet it.
My God, look at that. It's like something out of Dante's Inferno. I mean, right there at the beginning, Booth goes with the iconography.
Yeah.
I know this movie way too well.
They foreshadow the hell thing with that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who's going to go next?
I can't talk, so someone else has to go.
David, so we broke you're up. Sean. What's your fifth like?
Well, I'm going to go with the robot designs on the Cygnus. I loved the Templar cyborgs and their funeral rites and processions. It didn't make any sense, but I loved the look of them. Reinhardt just saying, "Oh well, yes, I know it's all very gothic, but I'm a romantic." And including in that, I loved Maximilian. In fact, I was just checking to see if I could get myself a Maximilian figure. The only model I found is $200, so maybe not. I do really like Maximilian, and there's something nervy about the fact that when you think about it, he's only about 4 feet high, right? The movie's deliberately violating the rule that Roger Corman discovered with It Conquered the World, that the monster must always be taller than the leading lady. And Maximilian is only artificially tall because he's floating all the time. But I think he looks badass, and the Templar cyborgs are completely nonsensical in the same vein as the Cygnus's gothic style, and I love that.
So I'm going to go next because that is also my last like. I really liked the robot designs. I really enjoyed the color, especially because they used the sort of purple robes for the one robots. And then Maximilian, of course, is this red demonic thing. And he has the eye plate where he would have had eyes, which is like a red patch of shininess. And I thought that was cool looking. And I enjoyed his KitchenAid attachments. I actually, like, we have a KitchenAid on loan from one of our friends that's been in our house for the last few months, and it's red, so I was already feeling the KitchenAid vibe from that.
Are you going to name it Maximilian?
Yes, from now on, its name is Maximilian. Go ahead, eviscerate this dough, Maximilian. But no, I really liked the colors of the robots, and honestly, old Bob and the way that he's sort of the dilapidated version of Vincent is kind of cute too, even though, like I said, I have this problem with Bob and Vincent are the worst looking robots in the movie as far as just they look like they're made of cardboard. But I still kind of enjoyed the look of them anyway. And I really thought it was super creepy at the point when there's the one robot that's not answering anything. And I forget which character it is that comes up to him and is like, speak, speak. Why can't you speak? And then the robot turns around and it's got like the garden globe face that's just like a reflective ball, and it's super creepy looking.
Yeah, that's Booth.
Yeah.
Walking around.
Alrighty, alright. Am I all this left for last like?
Yeah, I think so.
Really? Okay, we've covered the music, we've covered the giant cosmic anus, I like the premise, I like the sets. Crap, I don't have a fifth like. Well, that's really unprofessional of me. No wonder I suck.
Well, I'll tell you one. The stock footage of space was very well represented as a guild.
Yeah, but I feel like I use that joke too often, and it loses its impact. You know, I can't do the guild joke too much. I mean, also, I got a letter from the guilds saying it was the guild for the guilds, telling me not to do it too much. So, yeah. Yeah, it's really unfortunate, but, you know, when the guild for all of the guilds tells you to stop making jokes about guilds, you really do have to listen.
Yes,
you do. Yeah. So I would just say that I actually like the spaceship designs. I mean, overall, I mean, it's kind of something you already said, but I did actually like the Cygnus, and I liked the way in which it looked. I even liked that moment when they were doing the scene with the where they were trying to compare the ship to other things. I mean, the scene doesn't make a lot of sense because why wouldn't the computer just automatically figure it out? But it kind of goes through all of the spaceship designs to kind of see which one fits the Cygnus. I actually really enjoyed that scene because it kind of gave us a sense of the design elements of like what kind of different types of ships there were and the various designs. Yeah,
and then there were multiple ships going out there into space. It wasn't just the Palomino wasn't the only game in town. It's like, okay, there's other ships out there. And they're from different places, from Russia, from France, from the United States. I like that international flavor to that.
I missed that detail.
Yeah, because they talk about Russians, experimental space station 5, France, Sahara 4, this United Kingdom. It's like they go through the whole thing, and then they finally... United States,
Space Probe One.
Exactly. So, and I get the sense there's plenty more that these, but they just finally hit that one, and there was going to be more. This is Japan Pluto 5. Yeah. So they go through a whole thing of those.
And that was the original title of the script. Space Probe One.
Huh.
Yeah, it's not as interesting as the black hole.
No, it's not.
With tagline, get probed.
Zing. Rachel and I are the resident. Yeah, Rachel and I think are just the resident sex joke people. So, it's good times. Okay, well, guess what time it is, y'all?
Time for our last dislike.
It's time for the final dislike. No? Someone else is going to sing with me?
No. Not this time.
God, come on, guys. Like, you know, I work up courage to sing on this podcast.
I just feel so bad for Paul.
He really does love this film. I feel bad. But in any case...
He just sounds so sad and defeated. I'm sorry, Paul. It's okay that you like this movie. I just am not going to watch it with you.
We still love Sean even though he likes Mac and me. We still love you even though you like this movie. It's okay. This is a safe place.
I will say they probably do actually still love you even though you like Black Hole. I don't think that Rachel actually likes me after liking Mac and me.
Don't go crying on yourself, Sean.
The major unstated premise of your argument is that I ever liked you to begin with.
Oh, wow.
Zing.
Ouch.
Paul is adorable.
So Rachel won that laser robot battle.
Yes. Yes.
But I will point out that we only have 10 minutes, so let's get on the dislikes.
All right, okay. Rachel, last dislike, go.
This movie's boring as shit. Done.
Okay. Julia, last dislike, go.
So, you remember earlier how I said about halfway through I really just kind of felt like I wanted to die, and that was partly not the movie's fault, but partly the movie's fault? Well, my last dislike is all the special effects in this movie, because I kind of came into it with the outer edges of a migraine, and it was not good. But I was like, well, I gotta watch this movie. This is the only time I'm gonna be able to do it. It'll probably be fine. And, I ended up having to close my eyes for most of it because the laser effects were migraine triggers, and they were just awful, awful, painful migraine triggers, both audio and visual. And it got to the point where Moss was finding the audio so painful that he was actually muting it whenever a laser battle would happen. Because he doesn't have the migraine trigger thing, but like I got to the point where I literally wanted to die. And that is why I will never watch this movie again. Unfortunately, another movie that I can never watch again is the Lego Movie, which is much better and I actually liked a lot of, but I also got a migraine from that one, so I can't watch that one again, which is sad. But this was much worse than the Lego Movie for that. And I literally like had to close my eyes for at least 50% of this movie, and then as soon as it was finished, I curled up in fetal position on my bed and stayed there until morning.
Oh my God.
Oh dear.
Now, the saddest thing about this is that Disney, having seen the success of Star Wars and noted that their special effects were done by ILM, which is Industrial Light and Magic for people who don't know anything about movie making, approached ILM about doing the special effects for the Black Hole and then said, oh no, they want to charge too much. We're going to make our own special effects department to handle this. And they made their own camera generated effects for this laser nonsense. And, it did not work out for them, or at least it did not work out for me.
I'm so sorry.
I mean,
that's okay. It's really not your fault, but that is the number one reason why I loathe this movie. Because it hurt me.
Yeah,
and I don't blame you for liking it. I think that it's fine. I totally understand that it's a missing piece of your childhood, and that's cool. And I think that it's totally cool for you to like something from your childhood that you have warm, fuzzy feelings for. I just physically can't watch it.
Yeah, I mean, that's wow. This show is supposed to not actually cause physical torture.
Yeah.
So
this is very literally torture cinema.
Like, that's not supposed to happen. Oh, wow. Well, I'm very sorry about that, Julia. I wish I had known, but I don't know how I would have known whether or not this film would have triggered.
Oh, these things, I just never know until I'm actually watching something what's going to happen.
Wow, that's Okay. All right. Well, I guess that could be like a PSA for folks who maybe have similar migraine issues, maybe tread cautiously.
Yeah, well, and I will say that, like, Moss also found the audio effects just painfully loud.
I did find that the audio did seem to be out of balance, but I wasn't sure if that was the version I was watching, and it was just like a computer-based issue. But, yeah, it did seem somewhat out of balance from my end, but...
The DVD sounded fine.
Really, yeah.
Okay. So, okay, well, why don't we jump to you, David?
Well, this was the very first film that I anticipated for years and then was very disappointed when I finally saw it. So I think it was my very first experience of that. Not my first experience of seeing a film that turned out to be not good, but one that made me wait for it. So because of this injury from, decades ago, that would be my final dislike, combined with the fact that, I know that I'm going to sit down and watch it again because there's just enough of it in there to keep sucking me over its event horizon.
Ooh, reference. Okay. All right. I'm going to save you for last, Paul. That's okay.
That actually works even what my last dislike is.
Okay, fair enough. I will say that my last dislike is I found the film very tonally inconsistent, which is a problem I've had with many movies. And it's a common criticism, I think, now. So for this particular film, part of it is a problem with the robots that I think in a different kind of film, Vincent and Bob would have been fine. Like if this was a full-on kids space movie, those robots would have been ridiculous but would have been appropriate for that kind of film. But this film feels, on the one hand, like it wants to be a Disney kids film, you know, something like Escape from Witch Mountain or maybe even something more cartoony than that, because Escape from Witch Mountain isn't really very cartoony. And so it feels like it wants to be sort of like a cartoon and then for kids. And then on the other hand, it wants to be like a cosmic horror story. And then it wants to be a sort of like human robot horror. Like there are these weird inconsistent tones mm-hmm. that I get from it. And I had a big problem with that because it just, it really made the tension it was trying to produce at various moments impossible to actually take seriously. Because I knew at some point we were going to have, like, Vincent, like, say something from Cicero or some shit like that. And so it just felt like we kept bouncing back and forth between these two poles without any clear reason for why we were doing that. And so that was my biggest problem, is I wanted to just figure out its tone and to stick with it. It's the same issue I had with the first Hobbit movie. The first Hobbit movie doesn't seem to know what kind of movie it actually is, and I feel it's the same problem here. The Black Hole doesn't know what kind of movie it is. It wants to be too many things, and as a result is not enough of each of them to actually be them. So that would be what I would say. On that note, I think, Paul, you need to go to your final dislike, sir.
Well, my final dislike is very meta and has been only reinforced by the revelations of this last go-around. My final dislike is that this movie turned out to be working so poorly for the four of you. Rachel was so bored that she had trouble coming up with likes. David anticipated this movie as a child and was as disappointed and had to revisit that. Julia and Moss had oral and visual pain from this movie. And Sean just did not like it at all. The fact that the four of you reacted so badly to a movie that I have such fond feelings for is a dislike. I hate that. I hate having caused real pain and anguish and boredom and angst in watching this movie. I regret that we watched this, basically.
Oh, I should add that I'm delighted that we did, and I was really happy to sit down and watch it again. No, I should qualify that.
Once Julia mentioned that, no, I wish we had never seen this movie.
I actually don't regret having seen it. I just can't watch it again. I feel the same way about the Lego movie. I don't regret that I sat through it once. I can never watch it again.
But that you actually liked.
Well, she found some things to like about this. She didn't have to fill it with bullshit like I do. This.
Well, and one of the other things about this is that I'm pretty sure that some VHS cassette we had when I was a child had a preview for this on it. But I never saw this movie, so I was very curious about it. And having a chance to watch it for this reminded me that I had been curious about this as a child and never had a copy. So it was sort of like, oh, this is this movie that I'm very curious about seeing.
All right. Well.
So curiosity satisfied.
Can we
at
like
what cost?
Can we have like a podcast hug for Paul?
I feel bad for Paul.
All right, so everybody make like a hug noise together. So on three, okay? One, two, three.
Hug. Oh, God.
Rachel, you did not hug Paul.
I did.
I didn't hear a hug. So by yourself, three, two, one.
I was in before it was cool because I told Paul to come here so I could hug him. So. Paul and me, we're already good. We're like this.
I did not hear a hug noise.
I'm making, but I'm making.
I need to hear a hug noise. So I'm going to count you off and you're going to hug. Three, two, one, hug.
We need to grade this thing.
Hug.
The hug.
You got to go or something. You got to make a noise.
I'm not going to make it creepy. I respect Paul too much for that.
All right.
Paul, I remember this. I'll respect you in the morning, baby.
Thank you. Let's grade and end this.
That was okay. We're not going to touch that. Okay. Yes, let's grade this. So we'll start with David. David, your grade?
I'm going to give it a C. It continues to frustrate me, and yet I also know that as soon as I hear that theme again, I'll want to slip the disc in and watch it again.
Okay, fair enough. Rachel?
be honest.
It gets an incredibly messy minus. Because it wasn't like, it didn't fill me with burning hatred like, say, Baby Geniuses or Mac and Me. I was really bored. So it's just,
Fair enough. Okay. Julia?
This is a hard one because on the movie itself, other than like the physical pain level, it's not the worst thing we've seen, and I don't want to give it the lowest grade. But on the actual experience of watching it and then having to go curl up in a ball and whimper,
I think you have to be honest that way, Julia.
Well, like, so if I go from the point of view of how much pain I was in, I have to go with an F. But if I go with like the plot, probably a C, I guess. It didn't do a whole lot that really offended my sensibilities.
Yeah, but it hurts you.
Do you want me to just go with the middle?
I guess I'm going to have to average it out with a D.
That's fair. I think that's fair. Two various but related experiences. Yeah.
I will say it's a D with the caveat that like I still can't watch it again.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Okay. I've been debating with myself between a C minus and a D plus, because I feel like compared to so much of what we watched, this is not the worst things we watched, and I feel like this could be good if it had been just a couple tweaks. So I'm having an issue figuring out the D plus or the C minus, and there really isn't a middle ground between that. It's either one or the other. So I'll just go with C minus. And just throw it to Paul.
I don't know how to really rationally grade this movie. If I have to be perfectly honest about the quality of the movie, divorced of my feelings from it, that's problematic in itself. So I don't know. I know it's not the greatest movie of all time. It's not anything like that, but I do have a soft spot for this thing, so I'm going to. But on the other hand, it has problems and it has caused you all pain and anguish. So,
Paul, I gotta pause you. Remember, I gave Mac and Me a B+.
Yay.
Regardless of the pain it caused all of you.
Like, also, this is not your grade about how it caused me pain. It's your grade about how you feel about this movie. So it's got to be your feelings on this movie.
If you love it, give it a good grade.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'll give it a... Alright, I'll give it a B+.
I think that's totally fair. Alright.
So 5.3, 1.7, 1.7, 1.0. So that's 3.7,
3,
that's
4.4,
5. Somebody's
doing math.
I'm trying to do math here. 5.3.
Do you ever feel like Paul is kind of like that guy in the Leroy Jenkins movies that's running the numbers for the chance of success?
I think he's just trying to average out our grades here.
I am, but...
Probably averages out to about a C, because if we've had two C minuses, a D plus.
It averages to a 1.89, which is just below a C.
Oh, okay. It's like a C minus.
Oh, it's between C and C minus.
Fair enough. Well, let's not stress over the math.
And that's because of me. Otherwise, this would be much lower.
To be honest, this is not the lowest rated film we've watched. It's not even close. Not. Remember.
And I'm not even with the fact that I was hurting, I'm not going to give it the lowest rating at all.
No. And remember, three of us gave us in the C range. So keep that in mind. We have watched films where none of us have given anything above a D minus.
Baby geniuses.
Baby geniuses.
I rest my case.
Ernest Saves Christmas must have been in the straight D's, wasn't it?
Let us bring back. It was. I just want to make sure everybody understands. The only person who gave it above an F was Julia. Who gave it an F minus. Yeah. But everyone else gave it a full on F. In fact, when we did Fantastic Four, we rated Fantastic Four as a straight C minus. And then we got to Baby Geniuses, which was across the board F minus.
Oh, I dodged a bullet on that one.
Oh God, yes. All
oh
I can
my
express
God,
to you,
you're so glad you didn't watch that.
Yeah, I just want to explain to you, David, that the only thing you need to know about that movie is that it involves babies simulating the post-coital phase of life.
Oh God, no.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. All movies, you know, just about any genre, if it's bad enough, turns into a comedy, except for comedies.
Exactly. Yeah, it just becomes terrifying. But in any case, we're done. We have covered the black hole. It's certainly not the worst movie we have ever watched, and we had a little bit of fun while we watched it. So on that note, folks, I want to thank Paul for coming on and talking about his childhood with us. Thank you, Paul.
Oh, poor Paul. You guys need to come up with something that I really liked from my childhood to destroy next.
Okay. I'm going to make this a deal then. Since Paul and I have done at least one thing from our childhoods.
And you did the Omega Man from mine.
Each one of you has to give one vaguely science fiction and fantasy film that is from your childhood that you think most people would think are bad. Okay?
Problem. I can't think of anything because, like, my two favorites from my childhood were Flight of the Navigator and The Last Starfighter.
Okay, you're going to have to work on something then. You three give us those things and they will be in the next poll.
Wait,
all right, I'll have to think about it, but yeah, we'll do
Julia
this.
Julia and I are three people now?
Say what?
You said three, but...
Yeah.
Well, David said the Omega Man was
yeah.
his.
Yeah, David's off the hook.
Was it really yours?
The Omega Man was a film I really liked as a kid. I remember that was me mounting the defense half the time with on that one.
Okay, then it's just Julia and Rachel, whose childhoods we have to destroy.
Which is totally fair, and like I will look very hard to try to find something that I loved and that other people will think is bad.
Fair enough. All right. So that's what we're gonna do. So thanks, David, for joining us to talk about this movie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julia.
Yes. I'm like,
I'm sorry,
you're
Julia.
Welcome.
I'm sorry, Julia. I'm sorry.
It's not your fault, Paul. It's really not your fault.
I really am sorry.
I just can't thank you for letting me watch this movie, but like, it is not your fault, Paul. I do not hold any grudges against anyone in this podcast.
Fair enough. And thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome, citizen. You're welcome.
And as always, Rachel, you and I will always have the space anus.
We will.
We can touch it together. Forget. It'll be wonderful.
Space anus.
And on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.